Right, this is the 56th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our speaker is Brother Ken Pawley. His topic is Jesus' juxtapositions. And the subtitle for today, the first talk in his series, is Wise and Foolish. The introductory reading comes from Matthew chapter 7, verses 24 to 29.
Thanks, Ken.
Good morning, everyone. Gillian and I are very glad to be with you all and really looking forward to share this week together. Now this topic, an apology first of all, it's a bit of a mouthful. Normally you often come up with a topic and then prepare the talks. In this case I prepared the talks and I couldn't get a topic that I actually liked. None of them sounded quite right, I suppose, so I said to one of my sons, I need a topic for these talks I'm giving. I want something with alliteration in it. Unfortunately, he was one of the sons who knew what alliteration was. And he said, I know Jesus' juxtapositions. And Gillian said, where did you get that word from? So just in case you don't know, a juxtaposition is when you have two contrasting things and you really play them off against one another. And as you probably know, Jesus used this technique a lot. He put these two opposing ideas up before us. And look, I've just listed a few on the screen for you, but you'll know if you think about it, there's many, many more. And the more you watch out for them, the more you actually see in the record of the New Testament. We're going to choose just one of them today, and we're going to talk about wise and foolish. And as you probably heard from the reading, it's taken from the Sermon on the Mount and that very well-known parable that Jesus gave about the wise man and the foolish man. Now, I'm going to try and do something with you today which may not go down all that well. I tried it out with the teens, and they did very well. So I'm hoping that I can tell them tomorrow that you've done even better. Because not only would I like you to sing this song, but I'd like you to do the actions as well. And I'm sure that many of you remember the actions way back from the dim, dark past. But let's give it a go, the wise and the foolish builders.
The wise man built his house upon the rock. The wise man built his house upon the rock. And the rains came a-tumbling down. The rains came down and the floods came up. The rains came down. Upon the sand, and the rains came a-tumbling down. The rains came down, and the floods came up. The rains came down, and the floods came up. The rains came down, and the floods came up. And the house on the sand went splat.
Now, if I was younger, I would go down on the floor, as a lot of the little kids do, but it may take me a while to get back up again, so we'll take that one as read. It's amazing how well you did. So, you know, I think you did as well as the teens, remembering something that probably many of you learnt a long, long time ago. And it's amazing how those songs we learn as children do stick with us. Just to give them a bit of a... Okay. I tried a few other things out on them this morning that you might not appreciate later, but anyway, we'll be a bit careful. Yeah, this is obviously one of Jesus' most well-known parables, and that song, of course, is embedded in the minds of many, many people from the past. There's lots of kids' books about this parable. Perhaps there's more kids' books on this parable than any of the other parables that Jesus gave. Let's read it. So we're going to read from Matthew chapter 7, verse 24 to 29. And I'd like you really to concentrate as you read, because one of the problems we have with this parable is we think we know it so well because of the song and the background we've had in it that sometimes perhaps we don't read it as carefully as we might. So thank you.
Matthew chapter 7 from verse 24. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and does them is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on the rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. And the rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it.
Thanks very much, Brother Matt. What do you think the message of this parable actually is? Now, I'm going to answer that today for myself, but what I would like to say at the beginning of the week, because we are going to be looking at a number of Jesus' parables, is that they have multiple layers. And I found that looking at the parables, as life goes on, as experiences change, often the focus that we have on a particular parable might also change. They change due to life's circumstances. They change as we grow in God. And the meaning that you take from this parable might be different to the meaning I take, which is fine, as long as it's drawing us closer to our Lord. A superficial reading is not really enough of these words of Jesus, particularly when we think we already know all there is to know about a passage like this. And I suppose I put out there the request that we might particularly go back over those things that we think we know well from the Bible. And when we read over them, as we often do, we assume we know what we're reading, and we immediately place our five-year-old mind and the things that our Sunday school teacher told us onto the words, whereas in actual fact what we need to do is to come back at the words with a mature mind, with deeper understanding of God and his word, with the experiences of life which change the importance of the things that we read and see. Now, I'm sure you'd all agree that good foundations are actually critical, and I want to take a very simple building example to illustrate the point. When we first built our property, when we first bought our first property in Sydney, we didn't pay for the house. It was just land value. The house was old, unrenovated, and it had lots of cracks in it. Now, for those of you who are into geology, the suburb we lived in was on reactive clay, so you'll know that there's plenty of movement whenever it rains, whenever things happen. There's lots of cracking occurs. We lived like this for a long time. The house wasn't going to fall down or anything like that, but you do a paint job and 2 weeks later you say, oh no, the cracks would appear in your beautifully completed work, and they'd be there until you did the next paint job, and the same thing would happen a few weeks later. Finally, we needed to do something, not because the house was going to fall down, but because our family had grown and room was a problem. And one option, of course, was to build onto the house. No problem, one very positive builder said to me, we'll have to underpin the house, though. We need to fix the foundations before we put anything else on this house. How? I asked. And he said, oh, we'll just rip up the floor, dig under the walls and pour some concrete underneath. And I said, being practical and an engineer, how will you dig? The block is not very wide. You're not going to be able to bring any big equipment in. He said, no problems, we'll dig by hand. And, of course, I could see the dollars escalating. I'd done some gardening and about 6 inches below the surface, solid clay. And those of you who have dug in solid clay will know that that is extremely difficult to make any impression on. So in the end, we found it was cheaper to bulldoze the old house and to rebuild from scratch. And I was glad I made that decision when the old house came down, and I found that despite the beauty of the exterior and interior and all of the beautiful woodwork and everything that had been done, there were just brick piers under each corner of the house that were holding it up. Not much at all under the ground whatsoever. No wonder it cracked. And a neighbour chose to renovate their house at the same time we chose to rebuild. And every time I drove down the street and saw the lean on the front wall of their house, I was glad that we'd actually built a new house with good foundations. What they actually did with the new house was come in with a massive machine. They dug 18 holes on one day into the ground, as far down as they could go until it was quite stable, and they filled them with concrete, and the footings of the new house rested on that concrete. It was a strong foundation. So foundations, I hope I don't have to convince you, are very important, but not just for a building. Foundations are critical for our lives as well. But this parable, what are the foundations about here? What does the rock symbolise? Does it have a single meaning? Of course, we can come up with a lot of answers to that. We could say, well, God is the rock, and you know, this verse from the Old Testament would prove that point. The Lord is my rock and my fortress. We could quickly glance at the parable and say, well, Jesus Christ is the rock. And of course, Jesus is our foundation, and that's fundamentally important too, but it's not the message of this parable either. And then we could say, well, the Bible's the foundation. And that, of course, is a foundation to our lives. And it's important as well, but it's not the foundation here in this message of Jesus. Or we could talk about our distinctive beliefs and doctrines as Christadelphians as the foundation. And interestingly, when I was first thinking about this talk, a new book came out called Built Upon a Rock. It's very obviously using a picture from this parable, but the subject of the book was actually looking at our distinctive beliefs, and I'm not saying they're not a foundation, but really I don't think that's what Jesus is talking about here in Matthew chapter 7. Let's look again at how the parable starts and think about those words. I've actually read the parable I don't know how many times in my life, but it's only the last few words that I actually really read, last few years, really read what it actually says. There's two key words there. Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to the wise man who built his house upon the rock. So the foundation here is not just the hearing of Jesus' message, but also the doing of the message as well. And again, I would restate that plea that's so important for us to reread the things that we read as kids and when less mature, and make sure that we are taking the real message that is there. Because sometimes our assumptions, if not wrong, are incomplete. And I found I was missing a huge amount of what Jesus was actually saying in this parable. And when we look at the context of this parable here in Matthew chapter 7, it helps us understand too what Jesus was actually talking about to the people here. Because without that context, again, we can head off into not quite the right direction. And context is all the more important when something like this parable begins with a word, as it does here in Matthew, therefore. And we need to watch, of course, those little joining words, because they're like a red light reminding us to stop and to think, to check, to reset. So Matthew records the parable with the word therefore in verse 24. And in Luke, the other place where the parable is actually recorded, we find that Jesus is actually answering a question that he asked. He says to the people, but why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things which I say? So these two things are giveaways. What's gone before is relevant. And just before this parable in Matthew, we find that Jesus actually uses two pictures. He uses the picture of the wolf in sheep's clothing and says, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they're ravenous wolves. And then the picture of the tree and the fruit. You will know them by their fruits, Jesus said. Do you get grapes from thorn bushes? Do you get figs from thistles? A good tree bears good fruit. A bad tree bears bad fruit. Therefore, by their fruits you will know them. And here Jesus is giving two pictures about differences on the inside from the outside. And we need to remember, of course, these two pictures when the picture of the builders actually follows. Jesus is giving a very strong message, not just from the immediate context, but also from the broader context, which is also critical, because in Matthew we find that this parable of the builders on the rock and the sand is the final passage of the Sermon on the Mount. And of course, the Sermon on the Mount is full of challenging stuff, perhaps some of the most challenging material that you'll find anywhere in the Word of God. I don't know about you, but sometimes I read those words and it makes me cringe when I think of those words against my own life. Some people say that the Old Testament is hard and the New Testament's different. That Jesus is soft and loving, always forgiving, easy, undemanding. But then we come across in this section of the New Testament, the Sermon on the Mount, statements like this. If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. And we're very good, of course, at saying, well, Jesus used all of these methodologies to get us to listen. And we have to be careful in understanding what he's really saying, that we play down the strength of the message he's actually giving, because he's using this language purposely. The problem with human beings is they're very good at hearing things and saying, oh yeah, that sounds great, and then immediately forgetting, being forgetful hearers of what we hear. And this parable of the builders is Jesus' final message of what some like to call his policy statement to the people as the king. His kingdom manifesto, if you want to say. And don't you think it's important that Jesus, in finishing this really important series of messages to the people, should finish it with this message at the very end? Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man. The one that doesn't hear and do is the foolish one. Each of us here today are building a life. And the proper foundation for a life is Jesus' words. But not just hearing those words, but doing them too. If we hear and do, then we are wise. Otherwise, we're fools. So we do need to watch the use of that wisdom, because often we associate wisdom with knowledge. And Jesus is not doing that here. He's associating wisdom with hearing and doing, and foolishness. Foolishness applies to those who hear the message and perhaps know it extraordinarily well. Perhaps are experts on what Jesus said, but if they don't do it, they are fools. Now, there are two hard questions that I don't think our Sunday school teacher introduced to us. You might have had a teacher that did, but not in my class. Would you actually build a house with such poor foundations that it collapsed when the rain came? What do you think? I mean, certainly in our society today, we'd say nobody was so stupid to build a house on sand. It's not a good base. You know, it's going to fall down. So what do you think? Do you think people are stupid enough to build a physical house on sand? Who says yes? Yes. Who says no? Oh, yeah. Who's sitting on the fence? Or as I said to the young people, who's sitting on the couch, you know? Well, if you think yes, you'll see a benefit in the parable, so perhaps we don't need to worry about you so much. But if you think no, perhaps there's another message behind what Jesus is saying here. And this comes out in a number of places, and we'll see it later on in the week in another of our talks. Sometimes we do really stupid things with religion and faith that we would never be so silly to do in other parts of our life. Sometimes we act as if our religion is about outward show. And I do know some Christadelphians who kept their TV in a cupboard. And perhaps you know people like that as well. Now, what's the thinking? Of course, you know, they didn't kind of think that having a TV was very godly. But somehow keeping it in the cupboard, I'm not sure God actually would have been impressed by that or have thought that was actually a legitimate way to actually own a TV, even if you didn't think it was a good thing to have. Maybe if you locked the cupboard, it might be useful. Now, I said to the young people I was a bit worried about this next slide because I actually did this slide before the Queen passed away, and I was a little bit worried about putting it up, but they took it okay, and I hope you'll take it okay too. I'll show you the next picture. Now, somebody has created that picture because I don't think the Queen would ever have dressed like that. But the point it's actually making is that sometimes we can put on a persona in this world. Now, we may do it with social media, and it's become quite an art form for people to actually build up a persona of themselves on social media and to give this impression of what they want to be seen to be like. Are they going on the right holidays? Are they wearing the right things? Are they saying the right things? It's a huge industry, and I'm sure you'll know about people who make their living out of being an influencer and everything they put on Facebook. I read an interesting comment by a husband who unfortunately finally decided to leave his wife because every event of their life was a social media extravaganza. And unfortunately, he made the mistake of when their daughter took her first step to leave his beer glass on the table, and it destroyed the pictures for social media. And he said to her, I'm more excited about my daughter walking than actually the pictures you're trying to take. And it broke their marriage up because the image became so important to everything that was going on in their life. And sometimes we can dress a certain way on Sunday and a different way during the week, and we ask ourselves, well, there can be legitimate reasons and motivations for that, but if we start to feel pride in the way we look and to feel that we are somehow better before God because our clothes are different, the message of the Sermon on the Mount has passed us by somewhat. We can do the same with music, of course. We had a bit of a joke with the teens about the comments last night about music, which really fitted with the talk really well. Because sometimes we say, oh, look, we're not going to include certain types of instruments or certain types of music in our religious worship, but we're very happy to listen to it. Our Spotify list might be filled with that kind of music. And again, what message are we trying to convey to God in that? And what is his view on the inconsistency that we can sometimes bring to our lives? And I'm not having a go at the treasurers amongst us, but I really like this little graphic, you know. We expect our treasurers to do a good job of the ecclesial books, but are they as focused on the integrity of their personal accounts? It's almost become a competition in our society to push as far as we possibly can with the tax office. I'm sure that doesn't happen in New Zealand, only in Australia. but how consistent is it? And we had some fun with the teens too about driving cars, because, you know, if we're taking our aged grandmother out, we're probably a bit more careful than we are on our own. And I know for a fact that there are some grandparents who drive really carefully when the grandkids are in the back, but when they're on their own, the expensive car they waited to buy when they got their superannuation goes really well. We wouldn't be foolish about these things, would we? We wouldn't have an inconsistent attitude in our life and think that maybe God doesn't see what we do. I think this parable's got a lot to tell us about what is going on inside versus what we are doing outside. There's another hard question too, I think, comes out to me in this parable. It's just earlier on in Matthew 7. It immediately precedes the bit we read. Verse 21, Matthew 7. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, Jesus says, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, and done many wonders in your name? And then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. Now, these people in this passage were busy doing. They were doers. Yet Jesus says, I never knew you. Is this a contradiction? Is it an inconsistency with the passage that we've looked at with the wise and foolish builders, which emphasizes so strongly the hearing and the doing? Well, yes, they were busy doing, but what were they doing? What were they doing? We're all doers. Every one of us is doing things in our life. There are very few of us who do absolutely nothing in life, but we're not necessarily doing what Jesus wants. Jesus wanted them to do, but he wanted them to do the will of my Father in heaven. Instead, they were practicing or doing lawlessness. And again, Jesus uses a very strong word, lawlessness. People who have no respect for the law at all. They were busy breaking God's laws. And so Jesus sets out to clarify doing as he concludes this signature message to the world. We know that the Jewish leaders at the time were great at doing. They stood on street corners so everyone saw their prayers. Apparently they even had a special gadget in the temple so that if you put a lot of coins in the collection, it made a great commotion. Great for the rich people, but hurtful for the poor, who, of course, they were not doing anything for at all. Maybe you could consider having a donation box like that in your ecclesia. The outward impression had become so critical and so important to the leaders of the people, to the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the scribes and the priests. But Jesus did not want a loud profession, a good record of all that they had done. Making lists of our good works is not Jesus' way. And the sheep in Jesus' parable of the sheep and the goats did not even realize they had done what Jesus wanted. And that tells us something critically important. Their actions were automatic for them. They were second nature. They had become part of their makeup, part of their character. They were not even aware that they were doing what Jesus wanted. And we can't do with our faith life what so many around us are doing with social media. We can't invest time and energy on our image, on the brands, the holidays, the friends, the food, the impression. This is not what Jesus is after. Work on the foundation is the message of Jesus, not a loud profession that is just words without real change inside. Jesus wants me to show my works, my fruit, to be a shining light, to be a wolf, a sheep, not a wolf, as a visible manifestation of him, not a manifestation of me. The first part of the parable opening is hearing. And if we really hear the message of the Sermon on the Mount, we will know the second part, what Jesus wants us to do. And the Sermon on the Mount is not about change outside. It's about change inside. You can't turn a wolf into a sheep by putting a fleece on it. But you can change a wolf into a sheep if the wolf becomes a sheep. And you can't change a thorn bush by sticking artificial flowers on it or plastic fruit. But you can change the thorn bush into a beautiful tree. And you can't make up for the loss of foundations by a very beautiful building. You need to rebuild that building from the foundation up. Now, perhaps these two men, the wise and the foolish one, were rebuilding their houses because they recognized that they needed a new house. And if that's the case, they'd got that part of the message absolutely straight. But one did not want to go to all of the effort needed to build a proper new house. Just a few shortcuts. Just a bit of an easier way here or there. We all know that transformation of ourselves is difficult. But you can't truly transform yourself by taking shortcuts. And that change that's already been mentioned last night in our opening meeting, that change of a caterpillar into a butterfly, explains what Paul was talking about in Romans 12, verse 2, and that word be transformed, what we would call today metamorphosis. Is anything left of the caterpillar after the change have occurs? The expert tells us that the change is absolute. It's not just a lick of paint or a good clean or some new curtains. It's a total transformation. For us, building our house for God is a recreation, a rebuilding from the ground up, from our very foundations, not just a few minor changes on the outside. It's about who we are. And the key is that word knowing. What it is, what is it for Jesus to know us? Unfortunately, Jesus was looking for sheep, and all he saw surrounding him were wolves. And he was looking for beautiful fruit trees, but all he saw were thorn bushes surrounding him. And Jesus was looking for the house with strong foundations, and all he saw was the beautiful facade that would collapse in the first storm. What does Jesus see when he looks at me? The doing of the transformation is what we need to focus on, because the doing of good works will follow automatically if transformation is ours. When a spirit of service is truly us, the decision to wash the feet of our fellow disciples will not be a calculated thing. I suppose when somebody asks us to do something like helping out in the kitchen, there can be three responses. We might say, no, I'm not going to offer. We might say, I really can help those around me. I would love to hand out the food to everyone. But I think most of us probably fit somewhere between those two things. We say to ourselves, well, I suppose I better do it. It's the right thing to do. Everybody's watching and no one's putting up their hand. Maybe I better offer. But what Jesus is saying is the true spirit of service flows naturally from a changed person. It will be prompted not by responsibility, but when we look at Jesus, what does it say so often when he sees somebody in need? Compassion. It's that motivation, the love and compassion he saw. He didn't do it because he was the Son of God. It was the right thing to do. He did it because of the love and compassion that he felt for those people that he looked out on, and he saw their need, and he saw that he could do something to assist them in the extremity that they face. That's the example that's held before us in the Gospels. So it's all about the right sort of doing. It's all about what really motivates us in our life. Now, what about the storms and the wind and the rains? What Jesus is really saying in this parable is that unless the hearing and the doing happens, unless we have not just heard the words of Jesus but really are doing them, the change will not be real. It won't really last. It will all just be show. And that might be okay for a while when times are good. We might look great on the outside, but what happens when real trouble or heartbreak enters our lives? Every single one of us knows that our real characters are not shown when the sun is shining and all is well with the world and with us. Our real characters appear when trouble strikes. That's when we and those around us find out what we really like. When they see whether we truly have a loving personality, or whether we're just putting it on, because I can pretend to be deeply religious when all is going well, but when trouble strikes, well, that's when I see and you see the real me. We can pretend to be patient, but unless patience has become part of us, when trouble strikes, our real person, what we really like, will shine through. So I'd ask you to think today about what destroys our faith and what will knock your house down. What is it that will bring your house collapsing to the ground? And in this parable, Jesus says it's something different to what we might first assume. We like to think that our doctrines are foundations to what we believe, and they are. But will a challenge to our fundamental understanding of the doctrines destroy our building? Well, for some people it may. And if that's you, the Bible does address that issue. There's a lot about it, but not here in this parable. For most of us, it's not usually our belief in one God or no devil or our understanding of the kingdom of God. Does that mean I've never been challenged about details of beliefs? Well, I have, but when I put those challenges against the loss of a granddaughter, we thought was a miracle sent from God. A child conceived quickly and easily during a period when her mother could stop her leukemia medication just long enough to have a baby. The loss of that child was a real challenge. That was a real storm. A real flood, a hurricane in fact. And when I look back at my life, there have been other events in life that have rocked my faith too. Cancer at 33, the weird eye condition I live with. But I find it easier to deal with something that happens to me than something that happens to someone I loved. And every one of you here in this room will have had your own storms and winds and rain, the death of somebody close, or a relationship challenge, or a family tension, or redundancy, or mental health, or children giving grief and angst. There's a long list of things. And it's hard, isn't it? Because in times like that, we can feel let down by God. And the biggest challenge, I think, for me has been accepting that God's plans for me don't always align with my plans for me. And it's hard to accept sometimes that the life I thought I would have, or the life I thought my wife or my children should have, is not what life is actually like. It's hard to accept that my character has some problems and that I need to face up to those and address them. So we each need to think sometimes, without becoming morbid, about what it is that is going to challenge our faith, what it is that is going to bring this house of ours tumbling down like that foolish man. And to remember these words, which we have to hang on to in life. Though he were a son, Hebrews says about Jesus, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. And we learn obedience by the things we suffer too. We are not just strengthened by what we know, but also by what we do. And I think the message that is coming out to me from this parable, as I look back now, later in my life, is that what we know, what we've heard, and what we do are both critical to our survival, particularly when times are hard. And again, I mentioned the choice that Jesus made about the use of the word wise and foolish, because we associate wisdom often with knowledge. But he's saying knowing facts is not enough. Wisdom is not just about knowledge, it's about doing as well. Practice makes perfect, and the practice of learning and doing the will of God helps us face the difficulties of life, using God's wisdom. Not our human thinking ensures our survival. And that brings me to habits for a moment, because habits has become a dirty word in our society to some extent. You know, people say, well, habits are bad, you know. Going through the motions of something can be a problem. But should they be? Do we have any marathon runners here? None? I'm surprised at that. The marathon runner has COVID. Oh dear. But you know well that a marathon runner, the first race they do is not the 100 kilometres. They work up into it. They will never attempt a marathon without running shorter races, without training, without preparation, without thinking very carefully about the way they're going to run that race. Otherwise, they'd be doomed to failure. They might even end up dead or in hospital if they push things too far. We know that to survive something difficult, we need to prepare. And this is the point Jesus is making. Our spiritual life is the same. Our character doesn't change by us waking up one morning and deciding to be loving. As humans, we're not all that good at the doing, are we? We're sometimes fired up to action. And, you know, we've got a few more days before January 1. So, Jackie, you can get out the list of New Year's resolutions. Why did you give up? Because New Year's is a great time to make decisions to change. And those good resolutions, those positive acts of doing something to make us better people, unfortunately drift away and vanish. For some of us, they might last to January 7, but for some of us, the New Year's resolutions don't make it past lunchtime on January 1. We're not very good, are we? We become loving, though, by doing many small acts of love which gradually shape our thinking and build this characteristic in us. We make changes by creating positive pathways in our brain. Each time we do something, it becomes that little bit easier. It becomes more second nature. Just like the marathon runner. Start with a short run and gradually build up over time. We do allow some half-truths. Oh, didn't I show the marathon runner? Sorry, there she is. We do allow some half-truths sometimes. What do I mean by a half-truth? It's a statement that conveys part of the truth, but we leave something out of the statement. You'll hear people say that if you don't feel like going to the meeting, you shouldn't go. You should only go when your mind is in the right place. And I call that a half-truth because, yes, we should be aiming to have our mind in the right place. That's what God and Jesus would really love. But isn't it true that often the way in which we get our mind in the right place is by doing? Back to the marathon. We'll ask the hypothetical marathon racer who's currently got COVID, do they always feel excited getting up at the crack of dawn to train?
I can answer for them, yes.
I've asked some of them and they say, well, no, sometimes it's really hard. Could you have run that race if every time you felt you didn't want to prepare, you turned over and went back to sleep? And sometimes I haven't been in the right mood for the meeting, but I went anyway. But I found that by the time I leave, I'm in a better place. I find that I learn more on those Sundays when I'm in the valley than when I'm dancing on the mountaintop with God. We do learn by doing. Interestingly, some who promote half-truths like this don't apply it to other things in life. They don't say to their kids, don't clean your teeth if you don't feel like it. Don't bother changing your undies unless you really want to. Don't bother handing in that assignment if you don't feel up to it. Not going to get them through life. So we can't apply different attitudes to running or to cleaning our teeth or changing our underwear than we do to our spiritual life. It takes us back to the reason for this parable. We need reminding. We can learn a lot about good habits from Daniel. Of course, he's another young man who figures prominently in favourite kids' Bible stories, but another one that we need to look at again with a mature mind on. I'm asking you a question there. Do you believe that Daniel, with the kind of relationship that he had with God, thought that eating the right things was more important than not worshipping the gods of the Chaldees? What do you think? You know Daniel. And the second question, did Daniel think the only way to pray to God was to open your window at set times and face in the right direction? That's not the picture I get of Daniel as a dedicated and man who was just so close to God in everything he did. I think Daniel understood something very important that we can learn in our life too. These habits were important for him. He had lost control of the majority of things in his life. He was in a foreign country surrounded not by his family, by his friends, by those who believed in the true God of Israel, but by Chaldeans, Babylonians, believing in a different God. People with a very different background and perspective on life to him. And so he chose something that he could impact on when he said, I want to eat simple food. If he had said to them, I'm not going to go to the tutorial today on the gods of Babylon, maybe he wouldn't have gone to any more tutorials at all. Daniel, I think, realized that these habits helped his spiritual life in a foreign country. Taken there as a slave, deprived of all of his opportunities, young, surrounded by difficulties and challenges, but he didn't let that define him. So not only did these habits help him maintain his spirituality and his understanding of God, but they were wonderful witness opportunities to those who surrounded him in a culture like ours where so few worship the one true God. Daniel held on to his integrity despite the difficulties and challenges, the wind, the storms, the floods that beset him. And it teaches us enormous amount about the value of right doing and how some seemingly small things that we do in life can make a huge difference to ourselves and to those around us. What he ate and how he prayed. It was those things that enabled him to survive the rain, the floods, the winds, the lion's den. Back to the parable. One final question that we need to actually consider. One of the picture books I read my grandchildren is a bit misleading. It gives the impression that the idea of the wise man and the foolish man was to build quickly, particularly the foolish man, so he could relax on his favourite chair. But our house, is our house ever finished? Our building is not like this kid's story where the builder sits and relaxes following his efforts. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but Luke makes an interesting distinction to Matthew. In Luke, the wise man is building his house, as against the foolish who built his house. The picture is not of two men deliberately selecting foundations, but it contrasts one who carefully chooses and prepares his foundation with one more haphazard, without care, happy with cheap add-ons. The building actually takes our whole life, and our building is never finished. Strengthening the foundation continues by hearing and doing day after day and year after year. Our life in Christ is not like school or university. It's not about getting the certificate and saying, I've done that now. Never again will I look at those boring books. It's a lifelong exercise in faith. Building on the rock is not easy. The structure takes time and needs continuing work. I love these words from Colossians. As you therefore have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him, rooted and built up in him and established in the faith, as you have been taught, abounding in it with thanksgiving. You notice the connections there with what we've looked at in the parable of the builders? That idea of receiving Christ, of being taught, that's the hearing. And what about the doing? So walk in him, abounding in it. And the idea of the foundation. Rooted, of course, more connected with the idea of a tree, but build it up in him fits so beautifully with the parable of the wise and foolish builders. This little parable has a critical message for us today. Looking at it afresh has certainly helped me in my life, and I hope it helps you too. It has a message for all of us. It has a message for those who think that the way to please Jesus is to study the facts and to become experts on what has actually been written, who become expert hearers. It reminds us that there's nothing wrong with being an expert hearer as long as we also become an expert doer. And it's got a message as well for those of us who think that Jesus is like, well, Santa Claus. It's very topical at the moment. It's just a few days ago. Santa Claus who leaves a gift at Christmas, not to be seen for another year. And certainly no need to say thank you because we don't see him again. He's not in the shops after the 25th. Do what Jesus wants is the important message. Because sometimes we do what we want and say, well, this is my outcome. This is what I'm going to do to show my love of God. But what Jesus wants is to do the will of our Father in heaven, not Ken Pooley's will, but the will of the Father in heaven. The strength is hearing and doing. The parable reminds us so powerfully that wisdom, as we've said, is not just about knowledge, but the practical realization of what Jesus said and did. It's about the doing, not the doing of whatever we want, but the doing of what Jesus wants. And the foolish are not those with a poor education or those who get tangled up explaining challenging concepts of our faith. The foolish are those of us who decide not to listen to what we have heard, or simply don't bother to do what Jesus asks. And the failure to do will have devastating consequences, the parable tells us, because it means that the challenges of life will bring us down and our structure will not survive. This impressive parable, I think, brings to each of us that critical statement that is James' own summary of this incredible speech. He talks about being doers of the word and not hearers only. And I think James has in his mind as he writes those words this parable of his brother. This parable when his brother spoke of the wise man who built his house on the rock and the foolish one who built his house on the sand. Hearing and doing is critical.